instruction. Okay, so I want to jump back into mitzvahs today. It's been a while. In the past few times we've met, we discussed Tisha B'Av, the Beis Hamikdash, we discussed Mashiach. But now to get back to our normal... So at least temporarily back to our normally scheduled order, we're going to discuss the mitzvahs today. God willing, in the next week or two, we'll jump into Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot ideas as well. But for now, we'll go back to our regularly scheduled program. So the mitzvahs that we are up to, like to discuss in the order we've been going in over the past year, the first mitzvah, there's two mitzvahs I'd like to get to today if we have time. The first mitzvah is the prohibition to not oppress or mistreat a convert, and another prohibition to not oppress or mistreat a widow or an orphan. I just want to first read to you the quote from the Torah to show how severe of a prohibition this is, and how God really takes up the case of a convert, a widow, and an orphan. So the Torah says, do not afflict or pressure a convert. For you yourselves were gerim, you were visitors, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict a widow or an orphan. So if you were to afflict him, he or she will call out to me, God says, so I will hear their screams. I will become angry, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives will become widows, and your children will become orphans. It's a very powerful, very powerful paragraph.
May I interrupt just a second? I did a Devar Torah on Parsha Ekev just 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It was my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, and there we talked about just that you have to love the stranger. Love.
Right.
Love the stranger, and it deals with widow and orphan there also.
Right.
For support. So this is actually an outgrowth of that?
This came first. I mean, this is in Shmos.
Oh.
And you're talking about in Devarim.
Deuteronomy,
a lot of it repeats what was earlier in the Torah.
Okay.
So Deuteronomy might be reiterating this issue. But this is the original source, is from Shmos. So we see that, God says you better be very, very careful with these people. And the explanation is somewhat obvious, but also we could always use a little bit more depth in understanding the lesson which is in this section of the Torah. This first, in terms of what it means practically, it means both emotionally not to torment and also financially. You have to, and even though it's forbidden to ever torment any human being, and it's forbidden to oppress any human being in the Torah repeats the prohibition for these types of people since they're so much more sensitive, vulnerable, fragile. So the Torah says you have to be extra sensitive to these people. Again, both emotions, verbally tormenting them, financially tormenting them, it's a very serious thing. So we shouldn't afflict or oppress or torment anybody, that's for sure. But it's a double whammy. If one was to afflict or oppress or torment a convert or an orphan or a widow, it's doubly as bad. So I want to take each one individually for a minute and understand the lesson which we find in this mitzvah. So let's discuss the convert at first. A convert is somebody, and you have to put it in context also. I mean, a convert always is somebody who's leaving their comfort zone, leaving their family, leaving their background and their upbringing, and changing drastically, becoming a Jew. And if you put it in the context of the Jews in the times of the Temple in the land of Israel, it was a more drastic change because they were probably leaving their land and entering into the Jewish land as loners, with nobody around, no friends and no family, until they became part of the community. So a convert is somebody who has no one naturally there to protect them, to help them, to support them. People who have healthy family situations have family ties, have friends, have relationships with people who are there for them. A convert is coming in out of nowhere, especially in those times, and nowadays also you have very similar situations. There's no one who's naturally there to help them and protect them. It's theoretically in the spirit of the law for sure. Some unfortunately some Bali Tshuva, they become observant in their families sometimes to reject it.
Yep.
And so they're unfortunate. But in the spirit of the law for sure, Bali Tshuva would fall into that. So he doesn't have natural protectors. So God steps in and says, since there's no natural protection, no natural support for this human being, I'm going to doubly support them, doubly take up their case. that's one point with the convert. They're more vulnerable, so they'd be more sensitive. And there's also a concern that a convert is mistreatable, returned to his old ways. He was a pagan, and he becomes a Jew. And the Jews aren't treating him properly. He says, what do I need this for? I'm going back home to wherever I came from, going back to my family. So we have to be especially sensitive to converts. You know, there are stories told that there are people who are searching for marriage partners, and they presented with a convert, a male female convert to marry. And some Jews might say, well, I'm a little nervous, a convert, I've been Jewish my whole life. So some rabbis have told them, it's just the opposite. If you marry a convert, whenever you take care of your wife or your husband, there's a double mitzvah there. Because not only are you having a family relationship to your husband and wife, you're also always loving a convert, which is a mitzvah to love a convert. So it's a positive thing. Yes.
Love the convert, or not to hurt them?
Well, there's another mitzvah, love the convert. We're not discussing that today. There's actually another mitzvah. You should love the ger.
Okay.
That's,
so,
yeah.
So basically, we're talking about not hurting them. So
right. Yeah, you're right. There's a separate mitzvah to love a convert as well. The verse in the Torah itself, that's just an interesting thing. The verse in the Torah says, why should you be careful not to hurt the convert? Says ki girim hayisem beretz misayim, because you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. So if you think about that for a second, being a stranger in the land of Egypt, what does that mean? It means that we can relate, at least historically, we can relate to the plight of a convert, of a stranger, because we were strangers in a strange land. We were oppressed by a foreign people who didn't care for us too much. We understand what it means to be lonely, to be depressed, to be tormented. And because we have that sensitivity and been through that experience, we have a double responsibility to care for them. And the lesson for us on a daily basis is a very powerful lesson, that the responsibility we have, we expect more of a person who can sympathize with the situation than those who can't. I mean, you find it all the time in politics. You know, this politician came from a more simple background, so he can relate to the common man. I mean, in politics, of course, it all gets corrupted and is skewed. But in our minds, you know, people that we can relate to, we've been through the situation, we know what it's like, so that person expects more out of us in terms of compassion. You know, you grew up in a very poor family, and now you've become successful financially. So you find someone who is impoverished, and they say, you used to be me, how could you not have compassion upon me? You know what it's like, you know how hard it is not to know where the next meal is coming from. You know how hard it is if you can't pay the mortgage. So now that you've moved past that, where's your compassion? Where's your sympathy? So that person is, in a sense, more responsible, more accountable for not showing compassion than those who can't relate to the situation. If you can't relate to it, so I mean, you can be compassionate, but it's not on the same level. If you know what it's like, and you still are not compassionate, so that's doubly as bad.
So you talk about converts again.
Yes.
But there are people who are Gerim Toshavim, who live in Israel.
Right.
Not Jews.
Right.
How does this apply?
That's a good question. It seems from the commentaries that this mitzvah refers to a convert who's a ger. A ger toshav, who's just a non-Jew who is permitted to live in the land of Israel based on what they accepted upon themselves, I think that they would be subject to the treatment of any other human being, but not necessarily the special treatment of a convert. That's what it sounds like to me. That was a very good question, though, because the Torah itself doesn't specify what kind of ger we're discussing. But from the commentaries, it seems it means a ger tzedek, as we call it, a convert, rather than a ger toshav. That's what it seems to
me. The interesting thing is that the analogy that's strong has to do with the case when we were never converted to the Egyptians, for example.
Right.
We were just living in their land, and that's what we learned about, is what it was like to live.
Right, so the parallel fits better with the Gertoshov, you're saying, than the Gertzedek. That's a very good point, very good point. I'm not sure what the answer is to it, but the commentaries seem to take it as meaning the actual convert rather than the Gertoshov. But very, very valid point, very good point. There's another point here as well, is that the Ramban points out that when it says that you were also strangers in Egypt, so what does that mean? So the Nachmanides, the Ramban, says that Hashem especially protects gerim, those who are strangers, those who are converts, those who are not in their natural situation. How do we know that? What's the proof positive to that? The Exodus. That's how the Ramban understands this verse in the Torah. Hashem sees the tears of those who are helpless and downtrodden. Hashem sees those who have no natural protection, people who are helpless, and number one, because of their helplessness, number two, because they turn to God more readily because they have nowhere else to turn to. And no atheist in a foxhole, I mean, that's something which is common in many ways in life. You know, when you have nowhere else to turn to, nobody, no human being is going to help you. You have no family, you have no friend to support you. So where do you go? You turn upstairs. So the Ramban says, what's the proof to that concept? That's the fact that we were strangers in Egypt, and God came in and saved us from Egypt, the Exodus. Those miracles show that God turns his attention especially towards those who are helpless and downtrodden. So we should be very careful, because Hashem hears the tefillos, the prayers of those who are on their own. And therefore, you have to be very careful how you treat them. So the same concept applies with the widow and the orphan. Widow and orphan are extremely sensitive situations. They're very vulnerable. They're very fragile. We have to exercise extreme caution as to how we treat them. You know, there are times in life we know that people are in very fragile states, and we have to act accordingly. Use our common sense. You know, some people, you know, can take it if you're a little rough with them, some people can't. And we have to think, well, this person, what situation are they in? What are they sensitive to? You know, the questions I ask, the things I say, the way I act towards them. If they're in a normal situation, okay, so, you know, we have to act nice and respectfully, but sometimes we let our guard down. But somebody is especially in a fragile situation, you have to be very, very careful with that type of person. And it's a very difficult thing. And sometimes we might speak a little bit too harsh to somebody, and we don't realize it, but because they're in such an emotional state or sensitive state, it really crushes them. And we don't realize what we're doing until after the fact. But people, we have to be very sensitive to people's situations, people's emotional states, and treat them accordingly. Halachically, according to Jewish law, orphans get special protection even in a beis din, even in a court of law. It takes a little bit more proof to extract property or money from an orphan. Because the beis din knows these people are very vulnerable, they're very sensitive, they're very fragile, and they get extra protection. That's you find even not just in an emotional way, but even in a halachic legal way. In the legal system, there's extra low protection afforded to orphans and widows, which isn't there for every other human being. There's a very interesting quote in the Talmud, in Masechet Shabbos. It's a quote from, ultimately from the great Amora Rav, one of the greatest scholars in the land of Babylonia. And Rav was going through an interesting list of who he'd rather work for. Who's the best boss to have? So it's a very interesting list. First is, I'd rather work for a Yishmael, for an Ishmaelite, and not for what's called a Nachri. A Nachri in the Talmud typically refers to a Christian, I assume. I'd rather work for a Christian, not for a Chaver. A Chaver in the Talmud refers to a certain Persian kingdom which ruled over Babylonia for a very short amount of time, but they were very, very cruel. And, you know, they laid a very heavy hand over the Jews. So I prefer the Ishmaelite boss, prefer the Nachri, the Christian boss, I prefer the Chaver boss, rather than having my boss be, it says a very fascinating point, a Torah scholar. Why? Because your boss is a Torah scholar, and you don't act accordingly, so then there's an extra punishment for you. We have a mitzvah to honor Torah scholars, respect Torah scholars. So if you're with one day in and day out, and you're not careful on the job, so then that's much worse. So he said, I'd rather work for a cruel non-Jewish boss, but at least in God's eyes I'll be in good shape, rather than work for a Torah scholar. Then if I mess up or I say the wrong thing to him, then God's going to be upset with me. So that's a very interesting quote, which deserves its own discussion. But he finally says, but I'd rather work for a Torah scholar than work for an orphan or a widow. And Rashi explains to us why is that. Why is the worst boss in the world to have an orphan or widow? Because Rashi says that, you know, their tears are very, very common. They're very sensitive. And if you say one slight thing wrong, cause them to be upset. So then you have this very scary section of the Torah which relates to you. That God says, if I hear their cries, then I'm gonna reach out and punish you. So he says, the worst boss to have in the world is the orphan or widow, because since they're so sensitive and so fragile, and you're so likely and vulnerable in that situation that you may come to say something wrong, mistreat them, insult them, whatever it may be. So I don't want to be involved with that. I want to stay away from that type of job. That's what Rob says. Now, obviously, if you need a job, you need a job. You know, but the lesson is an important lesson, which is that the sensitivity of a human being who's in a vulnerable situation and in a fragile situation is so important for us to be aware of, that even when it comes down to working for a cruel boss versus that type of person, to even have the slight chance that I might insult this person, might cause this person to feel sad, to feel dejected, to remember their plight, to remember their sorrows, that's something which we should avoid in any way, shape, or form, as the Rav's telling us in the Gemara. So this is all type of training. Yeah.
Sorry.
Sure. You can come closer if you'd like. That's fine too. Yeah.
Just the way life is, you know, that loss is, you know, that's in our adults, because, you know, when you just say, we're Chinese, I'm more focused on children, which is what comes to my mind. And I was just thinking, what if, are we all orphans at some point?
Right. That's a great question. I think in terms of the letter of the law, an orphan refers to a minor. In terms of the spirit of the law, though, I mean, if somebody is fragile and sensitive at this point, do you have the spirit of the law there? If in the letter of the law, the term yasom in Hebrew, orphan, usually refers to a minor who's lost their parents. That's what it refers to. That's a very good question. So this is all just a training for a person to develop their sensitivities, develop their midos, become a more sensitive people, understanding others' emotions, other stages in life. So as I mentioned before, you know, there's the letter of the law and there's the spirit of the law. So the letter of the law, the Torah is telling you, applies to the convert, applies to the orphan and widow. And the orphan seems to be, like we just said, a minor orphan. But the spirit of the law applies in everyday life, because the spirit of the law is be sensitive to those who are around us, understand their emotional states of being, and treat them accordingly. Don't say things to them which might, you know, cause them to feel distressed, to feel sad, to remember difficult times in life. Try to just be extremely sensitive to those around us. There's a way you can treat your good buddy, and this is a way to treat somebody who's not your good buddy. It's a way to treat somebody who's going through a special time in life, which is a way to treat somebody who's going through a difficult time in life. Somebody who's, God forbid, sick, has a sick relative, lost a job, etc. There's a way to speak to them. Somebody who's, you know, things are going well, there's a way to speak to them. But we have to be sensitive to people and where they are in life. And try not to, and sometimes we'll ask an innocent question, but when you think back at it, it turns out to be very insensitive. You know, there's situations, let's say we're aware of somebody who is, you know, going through some sort of medical treatment, and you start discussing with them, you know, all sorts of types of exercise regimens you've been going through, which they can't do because they're very weakened from their treatment. So for them, it's, you know, it seems like an innocent question. Yeah, I'm going out to exercise now, and I'm going running, I'm listening to that. But this person wishes they could do it, and they can't because they're going through treatments. So, yeah.
The person who tells you about somebody that they know who had that ailment, and they go through a whole thing with, hopefully the person got better.
Right.
You know, sometimes they...
Right. So people think they're innocent. Yeah, right. Saying too much also. But yeah, so these are the sensitivities we have to have. You know, somebody, say there's a young couple struggling to have a child, and then you start speaking about your children. There's somebody struggling to find a wife, and you start speaking. You know, there's all sorts of things we talk about, which you have to be sensitive to people. You know, where are they emotionally? What are their struggles? And make sure what you say is not going to cause that person to have bad feelings.
So we carry that to very interesting limits in terms of the restriction of where it sits us out in the cemetery, because the dead people no longer have the obligation to.
So right.
There.
Yeah, that's a great parallel. Yeah, that's a great parallel.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't.
Yeah, there's a concept that those who are dead no longer can perform mitzvahs. If you're flaunting your mitzvah, so then they'll become jealous.
Okay. If you talk about this in front of women, do they feel bad?
I think the difference was that someone who's dead had the opportunity and then lost it. A woman never was supposed to.
Someone, you know,
a dead male. The question, I guess the difference would be if you're in a cemetery of all women. Would that,
the women
right.
feel bad that they can't do the mitzvah?
Can you ask the women?
No.
By the way,
you would like to.
I would like to. I'm not happy.
Right.
See why you need more.
Well, at first, if a woman talks about going to the mikvah, but the guys feel bad because they get to say a bracha and the men don't.
Right. I think there's a difference. I mean,
it's unending.
I see a difference between a mitzvah which you were able to do and you lost versus one which you never have the obligation to do. Somebody who's died had an obligation, had those opportunities, and then can no longer fulfill it. It's like, God forbid, somebody who becomes sick and can no longer do what they used to do. Because I used to be able to do this, I can't do it. Somebody who never had that obligation, so that's who they are, that's what God expects out of them. There's no reason to feel bad about that. But if, you know, every day of my life I used to wear tzitzis, now that the person is gone, they can't perform the mitzvah anymore, so then there's an emotional connection to that mitzvah which they can no longer perform. But I like that, it's a very good application. I like your application very much.
I don't think it's really dealing with space, with the dead person. It's dealing with the living person. Giving him the lesson.
A sensitivity.
Obviously, we know that, you know, probably the dead person is, you know, we have different ideas of what happens after you die in terms of whether you care or so on.
Right.
But the lesson is really from the living person that tells you that you have to be sensitive, even with, you know, it's like the same idea as covering the challah, because the challah would be embarrassed.
Right. It's for you, it's not for the challah. Right.
It's for you. The same thing, I think, is also the living person that it teaches you this lesson.
Right. I mean, there are concepts of those who have passed away being aware of this world.
That's right.
But overall,
in fact, we just had it in the Dafyomi.
We're the Dafyomi people here now, starting the cycle. Right.
Yeah, but now what about Shoftim right now? What we're reading right now, and it says that we shouldn't be dealing in ghost issues. In other words, we have to necromania.
But that's to do more with seeking the advice of those who passed on versus just knowing that they do have an awareness of this world. There's a difference. I shouldn't be seeking the advice of those who have left this world.
Okay.
But the fact that they are aware of this world is a different discussion. But that's their business, not our business.
I have another question. Can I go back to what Phil said earlier about Baal Teshuva? How does that fit into this?
So I think certainly in the spirit of the law, it fits right in. Somebody who's a Baal Teshuva and has difficulties with their old relationships, their family, their friends, so that person enters into a new community also as someone of a loner. And they don't have that natural support system, at least in terms of their religious life. And certainly the spirit of the law applies to them, too. The letter of the law, I don't think applies, but I think the spirit of the law certainly applies. And every single law in the Torah has its specific details, but also has its lesson. The lesson applies to any person who's on their own, who's a sojourner, who's a loner, who doesn't have that support system like everyone else has. So then you need to have extra sensitivity. Yes, unfortunately, in these days, many Baalei Teshuva have become more observant in their family, doesn't understand, and doesn't support what they're doing, so they have that same issue. They don't have that support system set up for them, you know, similar to a convert in the times of the temple. Yeah, so I think certainly the spirit of the law is very, very relevant to that situation.
You hear people talking in the shuls when you go down, you hear people talking about their shvigars and their aunts and their uncles and they're having bar mitzvahs and the Baal Teshuva doesn't have any of that.
Right.
And then so you feel like, gee, I don't have any of these great symptoms going on, and I'm just kind of left out.
Right.
And I'm not really invited too much either, so you get other feelings.
Yes, that's you know, sensitivity.
They are bringing it from, and they have relatives or not, and then they have weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Out of friction. Yeah, you know, we've experienced it too. It's a tough situation. But yeah, this mitzvah, so those who are from and who are observant and sensitive to it, has to make sure that to treat that person with extra sensitivity, because they don't have that same support, that same structure that the person who may have a very large observant family may have also. I think it's totally relevant.
It goes both ways, of course.
In terms of what?
Be sympathetic for the family.
Oh yeah, I mean, best to be obviously a respect and understanding of the family as well. Yeah, for sure. And the situations vary, you know, very much as to how the family relates to the Baal Teshuva. Also, you know, some totally reject, some totally support, and some have, you know, every family is different. You know, I've seen many different situations, many different experiences, but every family has their own way in which they embrace or reject or. Some of us are ignoring it. You know, other families is kind of ignoring the situation.
Is there any chance this can also involve the idea of a parent saying Kaddish for a child because the child has done wrong?
Because
the child has done wrong. Yeah. Done wrong. In other words, the parent disowns.
I don't think that's in Jewish law at all.
Yeah,
I don't know.
We see this.
I've heard stories of it, the kind of legends of it.
Asking, yeah.
Yeah, I don't really know where that fits in. Jewish law. I'm not really sure how that fits in. These are stories you hear floating around, or legends of people. Right.
Well,
yeah. I don't know. Right. Yeah, I'm not sure of any source for that in practice anywhere. I don't know.
Okay.
Right. So this is one mitzvah, which you read it seems straightforward, but it has very practical everyday lessons, and even if we're not dealing with an orphan, a widow, or a convert, it's still very, very practical lessons. The next mitzvah I want to discuss today, and this one will probably begin today and probably finish up next week, it's the next portion in the Torah here in Parshas Mishpatim. and it talks about the mitzvah of giving out loans. And the mitzvah, just in terms of Jewish law, the mitzvah to give out a loan applies both to giving out a loan to someone who's poor, and even someone who's wealthy who needs a loan. It's not limited to poor people. So the precedence, you know, there is an idea that the poor person would precede the wealthier person in terms of receiving the loan. But there is a mitzvah to give out loans to a Jew who asks you. If, again, within your means and your capabilities, but there is a mitzvah to give out loans. Obviously, like we said, the mitzvah to loan somebody, to give a loan to somebody who is poor, takes precedence over somebody else who needs a loan as well. But I want to discuss a general perspective on the mitzvah of tzedakah, of giving out charity, and then understand where the loans fit in. Because giving out a loan to someone who's poor is also a form of tzedakah. And it seems to be the highest form of tzedakah, which we'll talk about, because you're maintaining that person's dignity, giving them the ability to get on their feet without having to beg or take gifts. So we'll discuss that. But that's the mitzvah of giving a loan. The Torah prohibits charging interest, so we're speaking here about interest-free loans. Charging interest is a long and complex halachic topic, how and when and why and where to charge interest, but the typical Torah loan is an interest-free loan, and that's what we're discussing right now. Just some general perspectives on tzedakah. How should we view the mitzvah of tzedakah? I mean, it's one of the mitzvahs which is, thank God, the most common amongst the Jewish people, the most well-known. Little kids learn it, you know, in preschool, and you know, we perform that mitzvah throughout our lives. But what's our perspective on tzedakah? So there is the first perspective, which I guess is a somewhat selfish type of perspective, kind of an insurance in a sort, but it is based in the Gemara. The Gemara quotes a verse, it's actually in last week's Parsha, in Parshas Re'eh. And it says, I didn't bring it with me, but it says, Biglal hadavar hazeh. So literally, it says, the words mean, because of this matter. But the word biglal is related to the term in Hebrew, galgal. Galgal means a cycle, a wheel or a cycle. And the Gemara says that poverty is a galgal hachozer ba'olam. It's a cycle which makes its way throughout the world. Meaning that it's relevant to everybody at some point. Everybody's family, every individual. Poverty is something which kind of cycles around. So maybe you're very wealthy, but your great-grandpa will be poor, God forbid. Maybe you're poor and your grandfather was wealthy. Maybe, I mean, it's something which hits every family, hits every person at some point, somehow. It's a cycle. You know, no family is wealthy and remains wealthy forever is in general. That's the basic idea. So since it could be you, could be your sister, could be your child, it could be your cousin, so therefore, to have a proper charity system in place is to everyone's benefit. So again, that's kind of like an insurance policy. It's kind of a selfish viewpoint on tzedakah, but it is one way to look at tzedakah. Tzedakah is a way which since poverty is something which makes its way through the world and to every family and to every human being, to make sure that we're always giving tzedakah and making sure it's something which is in the blood of every Jewish person. Therefore, when it, God forbid, hits myself or my family, there will be those generous Jews out there who help support us and we'll put us back on our feet. So that's one perspective on tzedakah. It's not necessarily the ideal perspective, the most altruistic perspective, but it is a perspective. The second perspective, which probably is the more ideal perspective, is the perspective of sensitivity and compassion. Similar to what we said before, that there's an essential part of a human being. We develop ourselves as Jews, that we have to be sensitive to those who are needy. Those around us who don't have what we have, we have to understand that they're lacking, that they live difficult lives, and we have to help support them. So to develop in ourselves that sensitivity and compassion is a very important thing. And that's probably the ideal goal and focus of tzedakah. And there's a famous quote from the Rambam, which we've discussed before here. The Rambam says that let's say you have all other things equal. If you have $1,000 and you give it to tzedakah, it's better to give $1 1,000 times than $1,000 at once. Because if you give $1 1,000 times, you're becoming a more generous person. You're flexing your generosity muscles. You're working those muscles. If you were to give $1,000 at once, so you gave the money, you performed the mitzvah, but you haven't become necessarily a more generous person. You've only done the act one time. So the more you perform one act, the more it has an impact on you. So again, that's all things equal. Sometimes, you know, the need at the time is they have to give it all at once, etc. But conceptually, our goal is not just to give, but to become giving people. That's our goal. So not just to show compassion, but to become compassionate. Not just to show sensitivity, but become sensitive. If we're trying to develop our own personal midos and become very upstanding and refined and compassionate people. So that's a general perspective on tzedakah. So there's a selfish perspective, which is that I need to have the system in place if it ever happens to hit me or my family. Because tzedakah is a cycle which makes its way around the world throughout history, poverty is. And number two, it's to develop sensitivity, have compassion, and understand that we have to care for those who can't care for themselves. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that giving out a loan is a greater obligation than giving out tzedakah. Just handing out charity is not as great as giving out a loan. Why? Because somebody's accepting charity. That person is already viewed as, let's say, a charity case. That person's already come to the point where they had to ask for money. They've already gone through that embarrassment of having to take handouts. That person hopefully now is known and is assisted and is getting back on their feet. Somebody who needs a loan, so it's very likely that person is not yet known to be poor, not yet known to be needy, and that person has not yet had to go and beg or ask for handouts, and that person still has maintained their personal dignity, hasn't gone through that embarrassment yet. A loan may help make it that person never has to go through that embarrassment. Asking for handouts is a very embarrassing thing. It takes a toll on somebody's self-worth and self-dignity. So if this person can just take a loan, get back on their feet, never has to ask for handouts. So you've saved them not only financially, but you've saved them emotionally. You've saved their dignity. That's what Sefer HaChinuch writes. So a poor person at this point who gets a loan and can now reestablish themselves has never had to expose themselves as needy, besides the person giving them the loan, not necessarily for that person. And also, they never have to go through that embarrassing situation of having to ask for charity. So that's why giving a loan, according to Sefer HaChinuch, could be a much greater mitzvah than giving out tzedakah. So in our minds, we think, well, a loan, you get the money back, and tzedakah, you just give away. It's a harder thing to do, is to give tzedakah. But in tzedakah, you always have to look at it from the perspective of the person receiving the tzedakah, not from your perspective. So the person receiving it, for them, ultimately it's better to get a loan, often, you know, in general, than get handouts. That's what Sefer HaChinuch writes. Yeah.
When I hear about giving loans, I think there's a requirement, please verify it, when you give a loan to someone, of course it's interest-free, but it has to be in writing.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Because not to come to any sticky situations later on.
What?
You want to make sure everything is clear, because or else you'll come to some sticky situations later on if you don't have it in writing. Yeah, that's true. That's the Gemara says that.
You make them write it out and sign it that they owe you a certain, you're loaning them, and suddenly you have a date on it.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Right.
When we talk about tzedakah, we talk about the highest level of tzedakah is where what I give, I don't know who's getting it, they don't know who's giving it. And then the next highest would be asking someone to give tzedakah.
Right. So what you're quoting is from the Rambam, which actually brought me today. I like to quote that to you, because the Rambam actually puts this one as a higher level than what you're sensing.
Giving a loan is actually
higher. Yeah, it's commonly quoted that giving tzedakah without knowing who's receiving it, without the person knowing who gave it, is the highest level. That's in terms of giving out handouts. You know, give a man a fish eats for a day, teach him a fish eats forever. I mean, that's really the highest level. If you put the person back on their feet in a way which maintains their dignity and supports them and keeps them going, that's the greatest way. And the Rambam says it himself. I'd like to quote that either today or next week if we get a chance. But that's the idea. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes that so giving a loan often will allow the person to be put back on their feet without having to beg, without having to be exposed as a charity case, not having to compromise their own personal dignity. Giving out handouts, the person's now receiving charity, and now that person feels embarrassed, that person has to expose themselves as being poor, and that's something which is a much worse situation for the person receiving the money. As an aside, what you do see here, which is a very important concept of tzedakah in general, is that tzedakah is viewed on the receiver's perspective, not the giver's perspective. So for instance, the Gemara says a very surprising or shocking halacha. The Gemara says, let's say there's somebody who is extremely wealthy, and they used to have chariots and servants that ran before their chariots, announcing they're coming. And now they lost all their money, and they're begging. So, ideally, the obligation of the community is to pay again for their servants and for their chariots. So, to put it in a modern perspective, there's somebody who used to drive a Jaguar, and now he's lost his money, he can't afford a car. So, we should just try to buy him a Chevy, which might buy him a Jaguar. Because for that... So again, that's all things equal. Obviously, others' needs might come before that. There's precedence. But all things equal, that's the goal for this person's charity case. Why is that? Because you have to look at tzedakah. The Torah says, Dei Machsoro. based on what that person is lacking, not what I think he's lacking. So I think he needs a car. And for me, you know, I drive around the 2000 Chevy Prism outside, and the window doesn't work, it's missing a door handle, that's enough for me. So that's just, if I didn't have that, I'm lacking that. I never had to drive a Jaguar around. I never had one, can't afford one. It doesn't bother me that I'm lacking a Jaguar. But this person, he was a respected person in the community, known to be somebody of wealth. He used to drive around a nice car, and that made him feel good. That helped maintain his own personal image. And when he's lost, he's totally crushed. If he were to drive around in a 2000 Chevy Prism like I do, he would feel terrible. He'd be reminded every single day of the respect he used to have, and now and that is his current situation. So from his perspective, he's lacking the nicer car. Even though I don't think he needs it, he thinks he needs it. Tzedakah is I'm trying to take up what that person needs. I'm not giving him what I think he needs. So again, in terms of the practical situation, you know, all things equal, that's the person you should get. Obviously, there's a lot more needy people out there who don't need to have a Jaguar, and therefore we should take care of more essential basic needs before we buy this person a Jaguar from tzedakah funds. But the halacha says that ultimately that would be called tzedakah, getting that person the nice car again, and restoring that person's, you know, 12-bedroom mansion. If that's that person feels lacking, that's what that person needs, so then that's how far the tzedakah would go. Because tzedakah comes from the recipient's perspective, not from the giver's perspective. So we're not supposed to impose on a person what we think they need. We're supposed to understand what they think they need and give them what they think they need. Yeah.
It almost sounds like tzedakah is in Judaism, but in insurance policy is in American culture. Insurance policy has to restore the person to make them whole, put them before they get damaged. It has to, the insurance amount has to pay them to a point where they're back to the original point before the accident or whatever.
Right.
So that's
it's kind of like insurance.
But right. So it sounds like in a way tzedakah is not. It's almost like the idea that you're putting them back into the same place before that they were before they fell down. You know.
You know the old stories or jokes about the person. You know, the guy's jumping off the building during the Great Depression. You know, they say, you know, what happened? He says, you know, I lost $500,000 in the stock market. So he says, well, you have left in the bank? He says, I still have another $1 million in the bank. So he says, I'm jumping off, because I'm probably telling the joke all wrong. You probably know the joke better than I. But I can't tell the joke all wrong at this point.
Yeah.
It sounds like Lou knows the joke. You could say it.
Please, we want to hear you.
I don't remember the joke anymore, so you can say it. You know? I know the joke, I forgot the joke. I know the point of the joke. I'm going to say the joke. You don't know the joke. No one knows the joke?
We're waiting for your punchline.
Now I have to remember the punchline. I don't punchline. I'm sorry, I don't punchline anymore. You know? But the point of the joke is that when you had $3 million, you lose $1 million. So that's much worse than if you never had the $3 million. You know, that's the basic idea. There's a joke that goes with it. I'm sorry, I messed up the joke.
Next week, you'll tell us.
We'll have to think back and remember the joke.
One third of my money.
Yeah, something like that. You know, there's some punchline which makes it a cute joke. But the lesson of the joke is that if you had it and you lost it, that's a lot of times much worse than never having it. Right. So tzedakah means that we... And again, if the person says, you know what, I understand that I've lost my money, I don't need the fancy car anymore, I'm very happy taking the more simple car, and I'm not going to feel bad about it, so fine. So he's not lacking that fancy car. But if he still feels I'm lacking that fancy car, and if he ever drove around a simple car, he would feel personally distressed when he's driving a car every single day, then it's our job in terms of a community to restore that car to him. Again, all things equal, and no other needs are out there that have to be taken care of, but ideally that's the concept of tzedakah. So giving a loan from the recipient's perspective is looked at as a much preferred way of receiving tzedakah, because it maintains dignity, it maintains the person's personal stature, and allows the person to become independent once again and get back on their feet without ever having become beggars.
Do they still hold by 7 year? I suppose you loan somebody money, they was doing, say, 6 years, they can't afford it, and the 7th year comes, you have to forgive it?
Yes, yeah, but that still applies rabbinically nowadays. But there is an idea called a pruz bill. You can sign a document so the loan will not be canceled. So that's really the common practice, to sign a pruz bill on a large loans. It's rabbinic. There's a way to circumvent the problem. On a Torah level, you can't even do that. On a Torah level, then every 7 years, you know, canceled. That's, you know, the loans are finished. But
I didn't know if it was still in
effect. Still in effect. It's certainly still in effect. When the Shemitah year comes around, you know, if you have having loans out there and you want to get paid back, you should go get approved.
Last week's parsha said people don't want a loan in the fifth year or sixth year because the seventh year is coming.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, because they were nervous.
Right.
Get their money back. So, I think we'll stop here. I'll add one more point for the day. And then next week I'd like to go through this quote from the Rambam that everyone's kind of throwing out there. The Rambam has 8 different levels of charity. And he lists what are the ideals of giving tzedakah. And he actually puts giving a loan as the highest ideal. So we'll get to look at that next week, God willing. But there's one point I want to add. It says here in the Torah, discussing loans, it says, in kesef talveh es ami, God says, if you were to lend money to my nation, to the poor amongst you, etc. That's the quote. So the commentaries point out the idea. It says if you loan my nation, God says, you're loaning my nation money. And the point which is made when it says my nation is that God's saying they're my people. Make sure you do it in a way which maintains their dignity. These are Jewish people. They're princes. They're kings. They're the children of God. So even when you're giving them a loan, make sure you do it in a way which is respectful, which maintains their own self-worth and self-dignity. Don't do it in a way which is condescending. Don't try to make yourself become arrogant because of it. Make sure you treat them like you should treat a child of God. That's what it means if you give my people, my nation, a loan. That's why the Torah stresses there, you're lending money to my nation. So even when we're giving out loans, which is the most dignified form of tzedakah, you have to make sure you do it in a way which makes the person feel good about it. Don't throw in any sly comments. Don't become too arrogant. Just make that person feel good. Make that person feel responsible and independent. Don't make them feel like they're becoming subservient to you or receiving any charity from you, because they're not. A loan is supposed to be something that's not a charity case. A loan is supposed to be something which maintains the person's dignity. So that's the idea of a loan. So God willing, next week we'll try to discuss the Rambam's 8 points of tzedakah and discuss tzedakah a little bit more, which happens to be relevant this time of year, because one of the big mitzvahs of Elul and Rosh Hashanah is tzedakah. Teshuvah, tefillah, and tzedakah. It is remove the evil decree on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, so this is a time of year where tzedakah should be very prominent in our eyes.
Yeah, we haven't had any questions yet.